if we are not just looking at having an emotional high, but asking what an encounter with the divine might be, an encounter with the divine might be not only overwhelming and scarring, it's an overwhelming and scarring that are part and parcel of looking at the world differently. Mm. The encounter with divinity as otherness is one that undoes the structures of our being. I think that's the heart of the matter. Mm. That's the heart of the matter. Yeah. And I think the great price of authoritarian forms of religious life is that the authority of religion or religious practice is achieved at the price of people's souls. Mm. They lose the possibility to encounter God. Mm.
You speak about the encounters that are accounted in the Bible, which some may see as the prime source and text of theology, at least for Judaism. Do you think that those encounters in some way, in any way, are still possible today?
First of all, I think, well, for me, being religious, a religious person, means that I cannot imagine being in the world, my being in the world, without assuming that this is a being before God. To the degree that this is the case, then encounter is at the very heart of it. I think there are a number of good models in the Torah that we can think about and that can lead us onto that. First of all, there is Jacob leaving his parents' home and actually going on beginning his own real personal venture and epic of his life, and Jacob in his comes Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. Jacob exits Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harana, and he begins his journey towards Haran, and the verse says Vayifga b'makom Vayelen Sham. He hits upon the place and falls asleep. Now, this idiom of hitting upon the place is the idiom of encounter. And he falls asleep because he has not realized what it means to be in the place. That is, in a more intensive presence of the divine. And you see this when he wakes up. He wakes up, he says, wow, ma nora makom hazeh. How awe-inspiring. I don't want to say awesome, because awesome is today used differently in English, but how awe-inspiring.
Awful.
is this place? And I had no idea. V'anochi lo yadati. So first of all, this gives us a sense of what it means that, of a few things. That first of all, you first encounter God when you leave the parental home. When you leave your comfort zone, and you're on the way, and paradoxically, on the way of the journey, you encounter the place. And really what vayifga means is the verb that's used for encounter. So literally you can translate it as he hit upon the place. But functionally, the better translation, I think, would be that he encountered the place. And indeed, this is echoed again in the rabbinic statement about the frame of mind and that one should cultivate when turning to God in prayer. So the Mishnah says at the beginning of the fifth chapter of Tractate Brachot, "Ein omdim litpalel al mitoch kovid rosh." One does not assume the posture of prayer without a gravity of mind. Kovid rosh, the weightiness. That is, what does that mean? That means to be present completely in what you're doing. Chasidim Arishonim, the first Chasidim, now I hesitate to translate it as pious because I think Chasid is being used as a kind of, I put it this way, the ancient devotees, that would probably be the best way to put it.
Devotees to what? Or
whom? To God.
To God, okay.
To God. The ancient devotees would, or the devotees of old, would would clear their mind, would let go for some time. So, kidei sheyichavnu et libam lamakom, so they could attune their mind, their heart, their inwardness, their selves to the place. Now, the word place is used as indicating the moment in time and place that of an encounter. So really the Mishnah is using the same idiomatic language in order to create the conditions for an event. And I think this kind of thinking is standing behind a major move that the Baal Shem Tov does, which is to identify the verbal structure of prayer as the structure of the Shekhinah, of God's presence, because what we have here is a score that we're being invited to perform, but perform through a complete presence.
Score as in a musical score?
Yeah, it's a musical score. And so this is one aspect of it. One aspect is the event. And what is the event of encounter? And why is encounter so important? A second element in it is that. The encounter is verbalized, right? Jacob in his dream sees the divine messengers ascending and descending the ladder leading on up to heaven. Of course, this is an extremely, from earth to heaven, this is a dream that is thickly laden with with archetypes that forge Jacob as a person is not only on a mere journey, but on the kind of journey that will lead him from fate to destiny. And then the verse says, and behold, the Lord was upon him. Now, in alav, in Hebrew, that v'nei Hashem nitzav alav, behold, the Lord is upon it or him. Now, in Hebrew, you can't, both meanings are possible because you would use the same word for it. And it's not clear if it's upon the latter or that Jacob suddenly senses that God is upon him. And him is Jacob, the dreamer. So that would intensify the encounter. And then it's turned into words. You, Jacob, are assuming now the destiny of your forefathers and going in your path. So it becomes a very rich moment. It's verbalized. And then we have a third element, which comes out in a different story. And that's the story when Jacob returns to the land. When he returns back home, he realizes that he can't return back home without encountering his nemesis, which is his brother.
Esau.
And he realizes that this encounter, for him, in his soul, is the condition for meeting God. Because if he is still in the bond of the deepest anxiety towards his brother, then he's still not been able to liberate himself from his fate. He's not yet a person of destiny. And thereby the meeting at Peniel with after he passes the canyon of Yabok and on the Jordan on the east side of the Jordan on the east bank of the Jordan, he moves his family over and his extended family. And before he himself passes, he falls asleep again. And this is the closing episode of the formative part of his own epical journey, because the epic is the story of the hero, and to be a hero means to be able to assume a self that is open to one's destiny. And he wrestles with the angel.
Can you say that line one more time? To be a hero is to
assume. To be a hero is to be able to assume an expansive self that is open to one's destiny. And two things happen then too.
Once you've assumed that posture,
the encounter is not only of the possibility, but the encounter is the consummation of the struggle that makes you who you are. And that struggle who makes Jacob who he is turns him, first of all, from Jacob to Israel.
The final struggle when he faces his brother.
Well, that happens already in the encounter with the angel before he passes to meet his brother. Right. And what that indicates, I think what you rightly feel, is that he's been able to overcome the anxiety of meeting his brother. And I think that one of the dramatic things that will actually happen when they do meet each other is that the fear and the anxiety that were before completely dissipate. Mm. And they dissipate not only because Esau was clearly in a different place and all these years have passed, but because Jacob in his own soul was now in a different place.
Right, he was a new man.
He was now a new person, and therefore worthy of acquiring a new name. He has seen God. Mm. But there's another indicator too.
Right. You said that there's two things you're going to add. Can I just ask a question before you go into those two points? This narrative that you're weaving is really beautiful. And I think the way that we can apply that in our own lives to find our own epics is a great direction, which I'd like to explore with you. But you mentioned a few times this difference between fate and destiny, escaping fate to embrace destiny. Can you just give a word to the difference between those two?
Yes. Well, your fate is what is when who you are and where you're going is dictated completely by the circumstances of your life.
That's a fatalistic picture.
That's fate. Mm. And the destiny is when you can assume a self-transcendence that enables you to turn the circumstances of your life into the material from which you're going to weave a deep tale of meaning. Mm. History can tell us the stories of fate, but the epic tells us about the possibilities of assuming a destiny.
So we don't escape our circumstances.
Exactly.
We simply find ways to construct meaning out of those pre-given.
We assume responsibility. We take responsibility. Now, here responsibility is not the same thing as blame. What it means is that this is where we are. We're born into a world that we did not create. We are born into a language that we are not the first to speak. But we are called to speak it anew. And that speaking anew is expressed in the Bible in acquiring a name. Hmm. And and that leads us to the second point, which is now be much clearer. And that is that the price of the encounter that seals your destiny is the limp.
The limp.
The limp.
Hmm. The limp which Jacob walks out of the struggle with.
Out of the struggle, you don't come out
unscathed.
Unscathed from a struggle. Hmm. But what it does is it it signifies the burden of your calling. And that burden is not, tells us that first of all, we don't achieve purity. It's a, in the sense that we are unmarked. No, we're marked. Mm. But it's very clear that this is not Jacob's limp, but rather Israel's.
Mm.
So here, an important thing has happened. And this will now open a whole new range of possibilities for us. Now, so the answer is, now let's return to your grand question before, which was, are encounters possible? Of course. We would not be able to live a meaningful life as people standing before God if we didn't think that encountering God in our lives was a possibility.
Before continuing on that direction, can I just ask, what do you mean that the limp is of Israel and not of Jacob?
Because because it marks the fact that he could wrestle with a God and come out alive.
And you're saying that's something that only Israel is capable of and not Jacob,
quad
Jacob.
Oh, well, that whole combination is of him. That is, that being Israel does not mean that you have not paid a price. Mm. You've paid a dear price.
Mm.
But the price you have paid is the one of realizing what it means to be as a human being in the image of God. What that means is assuming the responsibility of Creator towards the world into which you are thrown. And ask then, okay, so where does God encounter me and where do I encounter God?
Mm. Creator as opposed to a passive creature that's simply the victim of their circumstances.
Absolutely. Mm. That, which is what I called fate before. Mm.
Correct. I'm seeing. How do we, so let's continue with that line of thinking. I'm very much enjoying this. How do we assume that posture of Creator of Israel? How do we come into that encounter? And what does that mean for us today?
I think, first of all, I would go with the Mishnah in Tractate Brachot about prayer that I spoke about before. Let's think about what the Mishnah calls us when speaking about a devotional posture. The Mishnah is calling us to ponder the place. Well, we are now. The place is Hamakom is a wonderful statement because you're never sure if they're speaking about a specific location in which encountering may happen. For example, the temple in Jerusalem, or for that matter, any house of God. It could be a synagogue, could be and it could be the Bet Midrash. and at different times also other places in the world that have been put aside for God, and to learn how to listen to them.
Would you include other denominational sacred spaces in that?
Of course. Of course. And it's precisely that raises the question of how do we go about fine tuning our place in different circumstances, and I'm saying this not from a Unitarian point of view, but rather from asking the question of how do we attune ourselves? How do we go about attuning ourselves? How do we hear different forms of music? So this is one complexity.
Right. Just to clarify, you're deliberating here or riffing on this word in the Mishnah and in the biblical encounter of Jacob of Hamakom,
right?
Place.
But Hamakom also is also a way of referring to God in Rabbinic Judaism.
Why is that?
The reason I think. First of all, in the Midrash and Bereshit Rabbah, there's a position that explains that we use the term or the noun makom as a name for God, because God is the place of the world that is the condition of being and not of the world. I take this to be a third or fourth century reflection on a colloquial move in the language that is done earlier. And the reason first of all, that the word makom indicates a saturated place. Mm. In Genesis and Deuteronomy, in Solomon's prayer.
Saturated with what?
Saturated with a sense of divine presence. Mm. I think this is crucial because hamakom becomes the way the Mishnah refers to God, because I believe it expresses a very specific theology in the Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah is a book in which theology is not foregrounded, as in the Bible, and all uses of the Tetragrammaton in the Mishnah are in the context of religious speech acts, for saying a blessing, swearing, taking an oath, but whereas in the Bible, that's a basic form of introducing God speaking. Okay, so that's one major difference, but it's part also of being aware of this allows us to, I think, locating the Mishnah's backgrounding of theological language and pulling it out very, very carefully, the very, very careful strands. Now, I think a very rare word in the Mishnah is Shekhinah, divine presence, and it's mostly, I think maybe all uses of the word Shekhinah are in Tractate Avot. which I take to be a slightly later addendum to the core of the Mishnah. This is a big argument about this. It's my own tendency. And we, of course, the canonical six orders of the Mishnah include tractate avot, but I think there's a good case to say that this is an important later addendum. But now, why am I saying this? Because I think that in biblical Hebrew, you would not be able to distinguish between makom and shechina, because makom is used to speak about a saturated locale, that is what the rabbis would recognize as shechina. The verb name shechina is not used in biblical Hebrew.
Right. It's the indwelling of the divine presence.
Or the divine presence itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, the meaning of the destruction of the temple is the divorce of Makom and Shechina. And I think that this is crucial for understanding rabbinic theology.
Mm. The divorce of presence and place.
Exactly.
Mm.
Mm. So you could see in the Midrash of Sifrei of Numbers at the end, where God says at the end of the book of Numbers that the land must be cleansed of blood, of spilling of blood, because God resides in the land, even as we are completely within our impurities. And on this, God's indwelling in the land, the Midrash says, in some of the versions, it's in the name of Shimon Bar Yochai, that that even when Israel are in exile, even when Israel are in impurity, the Shekhinah is with them. So the Shekhinah exiles from the land. And the divorce between Shekhinah and Makom means that we are now journeying in a world where it is never self-evident that our encounters are really saturated.
Did you say that line one more time?
Yeah.
It's never...
That we are journeying in a world in which we are never sure, or it is never self-evident that our encounters are saturated with divine presence.
Mm.
That's the meaning of exile.
Hmm. Are you saying that there's a necessity to embrace that uncertainty and doubt?
I don't think we have a choice but to do that.
Hmm.
Because otherwise we would have to succumb to one of two things, either to deny. There are two ways of denying exile. One by saying that you are redeemed, and the other by saying that there's no need to be redeemed. Mm. And I take these to be the two seductions of of living in a world in which the notion of God as a possibility is a major part of the tradition of this world. So
of God as a possibility?
Yeah. What do I mean by God as a possibility? By the idea that we can think of our being in the world as being in the presence of God.
You're saying the belief that we may actually be in the presence of God is what allows for those two possible seductions to...
Of course, because if one thinks that you've overcome the abyss between God and human beings, then you think that there's no such thing as exile.
And you're saying that we need to resist those seductions.
Yes.
So you're saying that God is not a possibility.
No, I'm saying it's because God, I think, is completely a possibility. On the contrary, it's because of that a gap always opens up between us and God. If you think that you've overcome that gap for one of two reasons, either because you want to embrace God or you want to reject God, then both these seductions speak to you very strongly. My own theological position is that what exile as historical condition and destruction as a historical condition divulge to us is that they would not be possible if exile was not our fundamental way of being.
If exile was not our fundamental way of being.
Exile is our fundamental way of being.
Isn't the rabbinic understanding that the world is created in a state of redemption, which is our fundamental state, and from there we are exiled, and exile is a aberration?
That's one way of looking at it. It's not the only voice in the rabbinic tradition. I think that it'd be very difficult to understand most of classic Kabbalah without assuming the other way around. And that the creation of a world means the creation of difference. If we were but another aspect of God, then there would be no difference between God and non-God in the world. And I don't think that this is the case. I think we live in, if I would put it in the world, in the words of if I would take over two important theological metaphors from classic Lurianic Kabbalah. The world is created by a divine contraction, by God making space for otherness. In Hebrew, tzimtzum. This contraction is what enables difference. And difference makes the shattering of the vessels of the world into a constant possibility. And that's why I think we live in a world of exile. The world of exile is the world in which the events of the world are not transparent to God, from our point of view, at least. They're not transparent. We can say the words. People constantly say the word, oh, this is God's will. I have faith in God. I think we have to be very careful with these kinds of statements because there's a sense in which the world is the will of God is trite. Of course the world is the will of God. But how does that assist us in understanding difference?
Right.
That's the question. Right. So I think it would be wise not to be flippant with faith.
Not to be flippant with faith.
Yes.
Nachum, will you humor some disagreement here? You bring up a classic Lurianic notion of the world predicated on Shvira, on a cataclysm and destruction, and that we live in that state of exile and rupture, as you're saying. Is not the Lurianic notion predicated on a wholeness that had to have been before there was any shattering, and that even in the place of the absence, the abyss, the vacuum, the tzimtzum, there's a residue, there's a presence in the absence over there, which fits with the well-known notion in the Tikkuni Zohar that late astar panu minev, there is no place which is absent of God truly, because even in the absence there is presence, even in the shadow and the trace there's still the divinity that remains.
There were two points that you made. One is that is primordial wholeness is a primordial wholeness of God before emanation. That's not something that's open to us. The second thing is that, of course, there's traces that must be the case. But again, consider Maimonides, for example, using the notion of the will of God. I mean, Maimonides says, what does the will of God mean? This is a psychological metaphor. God doesn't have a psyche, but what do we mean when we say will of God? What means is, Maimonides would say that any questioning of the world would come to a point of givenness. This is the way things are. That's the meaning of God's will.
Right.
That there's an end to questions at a certain point.
Right.
But note that in Maimonides' use, that's not explanatory. It doesn't help us understand our predicament. In the same way, I would say that the notion of divine trace is traces of divinity in the world are leading us, is what we're following constantly. The traces are everywhere. Our ability to turn them into a thicker notion of presence depends first and foremost on our own presence. It's not given as self-evident. Even notice in the way you asked the question, you moved from the fullness of divinity. I assume that would mean only before emanation, to traces, to letatar panui mine, that there's no place in which you have a vacuum. Let's say panui is a strong verb. of God. And it's turned into full circle into a very thick notion of presence. And I'm saying basically, if you want, what I'm trying to put forth is a sober form of ecstasy. It's in its very literal or etymological meaning, that thinking of ecstasy as ecstasis, of our ability to transcend our particular modes of being, to question them, rather than a fullness of enthusiasm that leads us to think that we've overcome difference. That's a kind of move.
What happens in those encounters?
Well, different things happen. I think the most important thing, first of all, is that we see anew. We see ourselves, we see the world in a way we haven't seen it before. It's suddenly we have a feeling that we had blinders on our eyes for some reason beforehand. Not for some reason, it couldn't have been otherwise, because we were in a certain place and we moved on.
Right, a sort of mode of being, as you put it.
Right, so it's a moment of aspect dawning. We see something different. Mm. Now, the aspect dawning is interesting, because it's not that every aspect dawning is a revelation, but the only revelation that makes sense is one that causes us to look differently at the world.
Mm. At the world and ourselves, you said.
And ourselves. Well, we're part of the world. Sure. It has to do with a kind of gestalt shift. We posture ourselves differently. Now, why am I saying that? You know, there's the wonderful example that Wittgenstein brings of the duck rabbit, right? Of a kind of image that you always saw it as a duck, and suddenly you realize that there's a rabbit there, okay? Or like the first time, you're in a youth movement here in Israel that was part of one's initiation when we were younger. You're standing in the evening and your guide is pointing out to you Cassiopeia. And you've never looked at the sky that way. And he's saying, can't you see the W?
Pointing at what?
Cassiopeia. That's one of the constellations.
Oh, I see.
And you're looking at the sky, and he's saying, the W, don't you see the W? And suddenly you recognize Cassiopeia. You will never be able to look at the sky differently. You will always see the constellation.
You can't unsee it.
You can't unsee it. It's a beautiful way of putting it. You can't unsee it. And so I think that's a crucial moment. Suddenly the sky looks differently. Suddenly you look differently. Suddenly you see your parents, your children, your partner completely differently. At its best, love becomes a possibility again.
Love
becomes a possibility.
How so? What's the relationship
once again,
there?
Because because it's the fixation of being in the previous way of looking at things is as it were a stopper on the very dynamic of living that love is. So suddenly something comes out anew. It's using love here is that most fundamental erotic flow within us that makes us full human beings. And as human beings, it is realized in a world of difference, in a world of finitude, in a world of exile, in which the possibility of encounter opens up again. And so what I'm trying to do is to point out that I think that the cash value of encounter, the cash value of encounter is not, it can have very powerful emotional sides to it, but if we are not just looking at having an emotional high, but asking what an encounter with the divine might be, an encounter with the divine might be not only overwhelming and scarring, it's an overwhelming and scarring that are part and parcel of looking at the world differently, of understanding. Now, Heidegger, for example, thought that happens when you have a real encounter with death. Because what death does then is clearly delineate the possibilities that are only yours. I think that's, as it were, one way, but only one way, of encountering divinity as nothingness working in our world. Now, what does that mean? It means that the encounter with divinity as otherness is one that undoes the structures of our being. It could be as a fullness, and sometimes it could be also a moment of annihilation. Yes, this happens. People return from traumatic experiences is different. We come back from war different. We come back from encountering our sexuality for the first time or the first significant time different. We come back from violence done against us is different. We come back from birth different. And it's those moments are so important, because it's not only focusing on death as finitude, but on the fact of natality, that birth is a possibility.
I want to ask you about this deconstructing and reconstructing of self that you're speaking of now, but you mentioned something just a second ago which I thought was interesting and worth asking about, which is, you say that the precondition for encounter is otherness, and I appreciate and hear that point. Doesn't instantiating otherness as a fundamental property of being an encounter also preclude a certain further reaches of encounter where being other is what allows the encounter to happen, but also precludes it from ever really coming to a point of contact because of one's otherness with what they're encountering?
I think that that's what the Song of Songs or the Songs of Solomon is all about. Remember that this wonderful ode to passion, I'd rather use the Greek eros than the Latin passion, because as long as we realize that our erotic capacity is not subsumed by sexuality, but rather that sexuality is one of its important articulations. Now, think about how this wonderfully passionate and erotic poem ends. Brach lecha dudi, oh, run away, my beloved. Udme lecha litzvi, and assume the image of an antelope. Alari besamim, on the mountains of spices, or of on the perfumed mountains, if you wish. Now, I think that this is one of this for me is a profound calling. She lets him go. It's not about feminine and masculine per se, I think, but it's about the ability of realizing that that the calling of love is not consumed by the fullest moments of a almost dissimulating encounter, but rather by the ability to understand that within a world of finitude, it gives us the self-transcendence and fortitude to go through with our beloveds through the entire cycle of their life, which would also mean to be able to be with them at their death. And I find this a very it's almost a shuddering realization that when you're young, you think that infatuation is the great moment of love. Then you think that great moments of sexual intimacy are the great moment of realization of love. You think that ecstatic moments of encountering God are the great moments of love. And they are all true. But they're milestones in a path in which the labor of love is also a call to realize that everything that lives shall come to an end. And yet to accept that as part of the responsibility for life. For the blessedness of life that we have. You know, when we first met and thought about speaking together, you asked me about mysticism. And I was reluctant to speak about mysticism the way it's usually spoken about, whether by scholars like Evelyn Underhill or William James, Rudolf Otto, and others who use this category to reflect upon our experience and our being in the world and our unbeing of our finitude. And one of the reasons I was reluctant is because I think it's a category that's used too quickly. What I tried to do now when we were speaking this past hour is to canvas a range of reflection on what a religious life might be. What would be a life of chassidut in the precise sense of a devotee, of a life of devotion through a self-consciousness of divine grace, right? And because like a tzaddik is a person who does tzaddik, righteousness, a chassid is a person who engages in grace in the world, in chesed. And I think that we see that there's very broad range of ethical possibility in not only how we encounter the world, but how we enlarge ourselves to be worthy of thinking of ourselves as actualizing a soul as a divine image. And that we thereby walk in the world differently. When you see it that way, you see that often terms like mysticism or like spirituality are used too quickly because they're used to bridge over an entire range of experience that we often feel that we don't know how to address in our world because we feel impoverished. We feel religiously impoverished. We feel metaphysically impoverished. When we look at previous generations where the people of name, Anshei Hashem, the people who are capable of assuming their destiny, have had a way of speaking. So I think that rather than use labels that that may bridge us over gaps in our culture and in our lives in a way that might be too early or assume forms of being that we don't have access to, not because of the limits of human finitude, but because the way a person was in the time of the Bible is a very different way a person is today. So what I try to do is to tried to canvas a range of experience that I think in which we can ask much more nuanced questions about our state of mind, our conception of the world, our notions of presence, notions of absence, and to make a pitch for the kind of reflective work that I think we need.
I hear that and I appreciate that, and I feel like we have been talking about what many would call mysticism or spirituality throughout the conversation in a much more careful and deliberate and a language which is minding the gaps, if we could say that. And I feel like in some ways as well, this is, one could say that this is a conversation between an older gentleman and younger gentleman, right? I wouldn't say, in many ways we could assume different postures there. But I love that notion that you said about love not only being in those moments of peak ecstasy and feeling, and whether that's religious or erotic, but also being there in moments of letting the other go on and to find ways of being which we don't yet have a conception of. And I was thinking of perhaps, what does it mean to love God after the death of God, right? What does it mean to still be? And that seems to be what you're describing in some ways here.
Well, Nietzsche proposed what can be understood as a theology of negativity, this nihilistic moment, where he spoke of not only the death of God, but he says we have killed him. Now, these are very strong statements. It's an indictment against the world in which we live. But I think that what Nietzsche was saying is something very fundamental to religious consciousness. What it means is that when we realize we have encountered God anew, we suddenly look with surprise at who we were beforehand. Now, Nietzsche dramatizes that. But think about what the Torah says in chapter 6 of Exodus. God turns to Moses and says, "Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe, vayomer, Ani Adonai, I am the Lord. Vayera el Avraham, el Yitzchak v'Yaakov. I showed myself or articulated myself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, Ushmi Adonai lo nodati lahem. But my name of the Tetragrammaton, I did not articulate to them." Now this seems to be prima facie not the case. Because the process of God speaking or in the name of the Tetragrammaton, think about Abraham goes throughout the land and calls in the name of the Lord, the El of the world, the deity of the world. And I think that what God is saying to Moses is that the manner in which Israel and Egypt are now going to encounter the Lord is completely different a completely new way of looking at things. And what that means is that divine name signifies something else. And this is an amazing statement, because to the degree that this is indeed a good reading of what the Bible is saying here, then we understand that the divine name doesn't stabilize, or doesn't stabilize meaning, doesn't freeze meaning. And from Moses' point of view, however great the achievements of the patriarchs, their God, their notion of God, is now way behind us.
Hmm.
That's in fact what Nietzsche is saying.
Hmm. Not only does it not stabilize meaning, its own meaning isn't stable, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. That is that's the twirl of the sword entering, of the cherubs entering Eden.
The twirl is the consistently changing, the always shimmering difference.
Exactly. That's what it means living in this world.
It's a difficult posture to assume. It's a difficult theology. It's not one of comfort and stability and sameness and identity.
Let's put it this way. It's not one of affirmation, but it's one of solace.
Solace, how so?
Well, it teaches you compassion.
To be in the uncertainty, to be
attuned to not only to demise, but to pain, to suffering, to shame.
To be sensitive to shame.
Yeah. Of others.
Of others, right.
About what it means to undergo shame.
Right. Right.
And I think that but it's not a religiosity of affirmation.
Right, right. It's a negative theology in that sense.
Right. Right.
Can I ask a personal question on that note?
Sure. To a great line by Edna St. Vincent Millay, the American poet. Personal? Of course it's personal, but it's not private. About her poetry.
Oh, personal but not private. Is there, do you yourself have practices that you've found effective to bring you into this encounter with the divine, otherness, as you've been describing?
Well, I think that the path to God is one that demands discipline. What do I mean by discipline? It means the discipline of being able to navigate the contingency of life through an awareness of how we build ourselves as being able to not only to field contingency, not only to distinguish in ourselves crucial distinctions between avarice, desire, jealousy, passion, eros in its full sense. These are distinctions we learn through living life carefully. So notice I don't use terms like spontaneity or inwardness. These are not the terms I use because I think that they mislead us. One of the things, for example, we have to learn is what happens when we are hurt? Do we know how to roll with a punch? It takes years of discipline to learn that. And if I return to the Mishnayot on prayer, there are two statements I think are very important. One is Rabbi Eliezer's critique of structured prayer. Whoever makes his prayer a set practice, it will not be a supplication because you close and not open. Rabbi Akiva says earlier, if one's prayer flows through oneself, he should pray the prayer of the 18 benedictions, but if not, not. And since I've been a young boy, I have learned how to pray by heart in order to be able to treat my prayer as a score.
Musically.
As a musical score, you can't play chamber music if you haven't taught yourself how to play a violin or a cello or a viola. It just won't happen. So of course there's a lot of disciplining you need on the way, but it's a disciplining that teaches you how to make the music flow through you. I think that's the heart of the matter. Mm. That's the heart of the matter. And I think the great price of authoritarian forms of religious life is that the authority of religion or religious practice is achieved at the price of people's souls. Mm. They lose the possibility to encounter God. Mm. Now, again, this is not a matter for flippancy in either direction. But I think we need much more care in fine-tuning our discipline and our discipleship.
Disciplining ourselves to be able to find those modes of connection which otherwise may become routine, to right. find ways to breathe new life and spirit into them, to blow melody into the ordinary.
Right. And it's like the game that Shlomo Neir taught us about the Mishnah's term, chagra. That many people read it, im shgurat filato befiv, understanding that if one has turned it into a routine, but actually the Mishnah is saying the opposite. If you feel that it's been sent to you like an epistle or a letter,
shagruot,
that is right, im shagrat filato befiv, it was thrown into your mouth, then right, and that's you know,
but not with spontaneity.
Now, spontaneity is a misleading point. I'm not arguing against the importance of the openness to the moment. It's about what we think that spontaneity gives us, the kind of authenticity it gives us, which I think is problematic in many cases, but that needs a different kind of discussion. I'm not arguing against being spontaneous. I'm arguing about preconceived notions of what we think spontaneity gives us and doesn't give us.
I'm going to suggest something which to the viewer may seem spontaneous, but it's been premeditated in some way already, which is to bring some melody into the conversation. How would you feel about leading us in some soulful melody?
Sure.
To bring us into the depth of the presence here.
Sure. I think when we spoke earlier, before, when we prepared ourselves, attuned ourselves towards this encounter, I mentioned the great genius of the melodies of the nigunim of Lubavitch, in which we're taught to think or led through our thinking by means of a nigun, and so a prime example, I think, is the nigun of the Alter Rebbe of Reb Shneur Zalman of Ladi in many ways a kind of a calling, rather, that you have on the high holy days, on the awesome days, Yamim Noraim, of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, in which we say Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. We have no king but you. So, Sinikon, I like very much.
We've now encapsulated both spaces of awe and times of awe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, space and time sit on the same function.
Right, right. So
they're time interchangeable. Space, right. I should. I na 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 I na 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 Avinu Malkeinu, Oyein Lanu Me Malkeinu, Hoyein lanu melech, Hein lanu melech, Elata. Aina na 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 na. Thank you.
Thank you. I had my eyes closed for the Nigun, and when I opened them, like the color and the light and the presence hit me anew, and I feel like a new seeing after the Nigun.
Yep. Then it did its work.
Yeah. Although I was reflecting on the words of the Nigun, that Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our Majesty, our King, in Lona Melech, we have no magistrate, we have no king, Elo Ata, besides for you. And there's a real directness, there's a real, this sort of old school style, patriarchal, monarchical presence, thou, you, our father, our king. And it seems out of touch with what we've been laying out here so far.
Well, first of all, that needs a separate discussion, but I will point out to one important thing. And that is the second person present, Ela Ata. Not Atem, the Ata, which is the big innovation of the rabbinic blessing. Baruch Ata Hashem. We encounter God one to one. And in this way, the alienation of power is overcome. And the first word of the verse, Avinu, our Father, and the last word of the verse, Ata, overcome the Melech, the King.
Can you even say Ata in a theology which holds pride of place for so much distance and space and absence and death?
How would we open the possibility of encounter without it? But in moments of bereavement, it overcomes us. But this is a good place to stop.
Thank you, Menachem, for giving of your time and your presence and your thoughts so graciously and presently. I think some conversations they come and go and they were and you don't really remember and they sort of just drift off in the sort of the stream of thing, the river of life. And some conversations really, they sit with a real weight of presence and they stand and they stay. And I feel like this is one that's going to stay with me for a while. And I'd like to thank you for being with me in that conversation.
Likewise. Thank you.
My pleasure.